Welcome back. We are talking with Dr. Ricardo Duchesne about his book, The Uniqueness of Western Civilization and Studies in Critical Social Sciences. A very interesting discussion about the West, about the uniqueness of the West, and of course also the origin points. And now we're going to get into a little bit more about the destruction. There's, of course, so much more we could talk about when it comes to the history. And we'll see if we return to that a little bit later as well. But it's been interesting to watch this as well, how the destruction of the West has been kind of creeping into academia in the last, really since the 60s, I think. But I wanted to ask you more about the treatment of the West and why it has been unique in that regard, why it seems like even questioning the origins of it or examining it has been associated with controversy and something which is, again, separating it from the other cultures out there, right? That it's been somehow it needs to be treated differently, or it needs to be walked around. There's so many issues there that we can get into. And why do you think that is, though? I mean, what's at the heart of this? What is at the root of this particular issue of why the West needs to be treated differently, do you think, Ricardo?
I think, like, right now, the academic world is determined to create a more egalitarian political landscape. And this is something that is also connected to mass immigration into Western lands. And the uniqueness of the West stands as an oddity, as something that is an obstacle and opposes that goal, that egalitarian goal, because it is quite difficult to acknowledge, on the one hand, that the West was so exceptional. And I mean, it was exceptional not just in the Industrial Revolution, in the rise of modern science, but we have the Renaissance, we have the medieval era, the scholastic method, Catholicism as the first religion that truly allows for reasoning about faith itself. We have a continuous sequence of great philosophers. If you look at the great thinkers, the great philosophers throughout history, really, I would say that 95% of them are European. If you look at the greatest scientists, again, over 95% of them. The greatest classical composers, I mean, it is about 100%. Who invented the novel, the greatest novelists, most of them are Western. If you look who was the most creative in painting, Westerners are the most creative. That doesn't mean that the Japanese or the Chinese did not create great works of art. They did, but they don't have the same kind of novelty, the same sequence of new artistic styles as you see in the West. They don't have that in China. And the list goes on, and you can go into specific details. What exactly did this novelist do that is different from that novelist? What makes this a realistic novel as opposed to a romantic novel? What makes this kind of art impressionistic as opposed to surreal or cubism and things like that? So this really doesn't fit in with the egalitarian goal of academics today. So they have decided to rethink history, to think of it in a more egalitarian way, even if it violates the basic principles of the historical profession. And so I think this is behind it. And as the West becomes more ethnically diverse, the pressure, the momentum to push this way of thinking increases. Already as it is, they have taken over all the schools, the high schools, the universities, and they're pushing, we all know that, a diversity curriculum. And so the West, the idea of the West as being exceptional doesn't fit in with that curriculum. And I don't point out that in the book, but in subsequent articles, I do point out about how it is that the teaching of Western civilization has disappeared from the American, Canadian curriculum just a few decades ago. In many colleges across the United States, including Canada, I'm not sure about Europe, but I would think it was similar. It was mandatory in the BA level to study Western civilization. Now, you don't even have people teaching Western civilization, and you do. as I do, I teach Western civilization, it is optional. And so I don't think that the egalitarian diversity promoters like the idea of Western uniqueness, and they want to suppress it, and the feminists hate the fact that most of these creative geniuses are men. They want to say that it is because men oppress women and all that kind of nonsense. But in reality, there's a lot of resentment and envy that they happen to be men. I remember having a discussion with a feminist in which I said to her, yes, I mean, 96-97% of all the great scientists are European male, and they happen to be white. And she was shocked by that and did not think that could possibly be true. So, yeah, you cannot walk into university today, and I do it, just tease them and bother them. I say and use this kind of statistic because I know they really don't want to hear that. And many of them, in any case, many professors are incredibly ignorant of Western civilization. They wasted their time studying politically correct subjects that don't teach them much. Because another thing about Western civilization, as I try to tell my students, is that you will become far better educated if you study Western civilization, because great things were achieved in the West. So you will encounter great philosophers, painting, music, and this is what will elevate you and educate you. So this is so important, even beyond politics, just as a matter of educating yourself. Studying Europe is very important, but it doesn't matter. These people are not interested in that kind of thing. That to them, education means learning politically correct thoughts.
Well, exactly. So statistics and facts are not allowed anymore in that regard. That's very interesting. And also, it's they've instead focused on accumulating all the negative things, I feel, that they can find about the West and Europe, and specifically, you know, with focus on war and slavery, although these are aspects that have not been uniquely Western. They have been attributed to all different cultures on the entire planet, but it seems like they're trying to achieve to pin certain behaviors just on the West alone. Am I correct in that?
Oh, yeah. This is what I meant earlier on when I said that the Frankfurt School, or the cultural Marxist way of thinking, was not the only school that was responsible for this. Dependency theory, in my estimation, was almost equally, or if not equally, important, because one of the arguments that these people made, Wallerstein systems theory of Wallerstein, is that the West created a world capitalist system whereby they were able to extract resources continuously from the rest of the world and sustain themselves and become more advanced, and that this is what made the West different and has held back and underdeveloped other areas of the world. So, the you know, this is an idea that also is quite pervasive in the university, and it holds the West in a very negative way. And then people add the slave trade, and the problem of black integration in the United States seems unsolvable, no matter what it has been done in terms of funding and trying to integrate them and elevate them and educate them and pass masses of money to them. It still hasn't worked. The gap in education is still there. The gap in income is still there. And everything seems to be getting worse in terms of violence. Black on white violence is increasing. And so, you know, they see these problems and they don't know what to do. And one way is to blame it on the West and blame it on white discrimination, on white racism, and see if they can keep, you know, pushing this egalitarian intention on everyone. So I think that yes, that negativity against the West is very deep now, and combined with the fact that people just don't read about the Renaissance, or they don't read about the great explorers of Western civilization. I mean, that's something that they would really hate to teach, that 95% of all the great explorers in history were European. They look at them in a very bad light. I wrote an article about this because I wanted to emphasize that, okay, fine, you want to say that the Portuguese and the Spaniards and some of the other people that were associated with the opening of the Americas were, you know, violent and that kind of thing. But what about the people who explored the North Pole and the South Pole and climb the highest mountains or travel through the longest rivers, and there's so many other things they did. They did not extract any gold or did not enslave anyone.
Right.
What do you say about them? Well, basically, they don't say much about them. On the other hand, the public out there is interested in these things, because I do notice that when you go into a bookstore, you will see some books on exploration there. People, you know, are fascinated by these kind of topics and stories.
Yeah.
But not in academia. In academia, they ignore this. And they prefer the idea that it was all colonization and exploitation. But I will add this, that there is no doubt that, yes, other civilizations like China, every people, Islamic people, have created empires and have colonized other peoples. So the West is not unique in that way. But there is no question that the West has shown a higher degree of assertiveness, pugnacity, and determination in the way they went about doing these kinds of things, the way the Romans went about creating their empire, the way in which the Spaniards created their own empire, and then the British and Napoleon and including Hitler. There's an element of energy and vitality associated with these things that you don't find elsewhere. And so, you know, you could say that perhaps Westerners have been more aggressive, but the argument that I make is that, and this is why the invention of tragedy is connected to Europeans, is that these things cannot be disassociated from the creativity that Westerners exhibited in art, music, and philosophy. They're interconnected.
Right.
As Spengler well understood. Yeah, but the negativity is what these academics emphasize, and they don't want to talk about the greatness. And I like to teach them about that, because, you know, I am in the academic world, and I sort of want to tell them, do you value ideas? Do you value culture? Well,
yeah.
I like to remind you of the greatness that Europeans achieve, and what are you going to say about that?
Well, exactly. It's like the focus on that aspect of our culture is off limits. And again, it's also about, it's just about balancing that picture, because if you look at academia, it's just an incessant attack on it right now, Western world, and it's been for a long time, and it's really leading to the erosion of it. But for example, you brought up about Britain and their global trade network. This is one of the outtakes from your book, is that academics are so preoccupied with the moral implications of the slave trade, the plunder of resources, and the use of violence in the enforcement of mercantilists' trade arrangements that they cannot see the obvious. Britain earned her riches through her own virtues and talents as a nation that deliberately set out to achieve imperial greatness. It was Britain's development of the best navy in the world, civil institutions, administrative and financial reforms that made it possible for her in the first instant to seize upon and appropriate raw materials and slaves in faraway lands. So we're back to that kind of paradox again, that it's, you know, you have to have a system in place for those achievements to even be possible of enforcing, but they don't see that. It's a myopic, you know, closed view that they have in that regard. And
yeah, and
just to pick up further on that point as well, I think you also argue that there is other situations where we could, for example, look at Spain, who acquired huge colonial possessions, but you know, ended up more or less underdeveloped and kind of lagging behind other European countries after a certain point. And then we had countries like Germany and Switzerland that didn't have much colonial properties at all, but they nevertheless became extraordinarily wealthy. So that's a way you've kind of broken apart that argument that, you know, many countries in the West became rich because of their exploits of other cultures, right?
Right. Even if we acknowledge or believe that England benefited from the colonial trade, and I do think that in the case of England, it played an important role. I don't think it was the most important role. Nevertheless, England did not get these riches as a handout. They had to acquire them in what was a very competitive environment, whereby other European powers were contesting and challenging England for colonies and for navigational expansion.
Yeah.
And so you have to look into British politics and other administrative and military techniques in order to understand the rise of Britain to navigational supremacy. And I use intentionally the word virtue and talents, because I know the revisionists or politically correct historians, they hate that. They want to paint it in a negative way. But yeah, there's no denying that however way you may ethically judge what transpired, that there is virtue and talent in creating an empire. And nowadays, because we live in very comfortable societies, we underestimate that life in the past was always a struggle and that you were always in competition with other people. Yeah. I mean, I think of all these politically correct people landing in Canada in the 16th century. They just wouldn't last long here surviving with those ideas, or they would really just change those ideas dramatically in order to survive, because they would be in a struggle for survival and they would have encountered people here who would not always welcome them, and either they fight them or they are annihilated. So a lot of the ideas that people have today, and this is a point that takes us into a very long discussion, it's not just about ideology. What is happening to the West is not because cultural Marxists have taken the West, is that we live in a very affluent, plentiful world.
Yeah.
And we don't understand anymore what it takes to achieve these things.
Because, sorry to interrupt, but I mean, there's, first of all, there's hardly any recognition of history. And if it is, it's a skewed one. But then furthermore, what's more important, I feel, is that the connection to nature and how things really work out there in the wild is something that we're so far away from at this stage, so that our behavior today with our current moral lens that have been developed in a kind of a, in an isolation really to the natural world, has been tremendously skewed. And people don't realize that, for example, having slaves and having colonies, taking over areas, warring with other tribe, that's been a constant throughout human civilization. There's a longer period, many, many times fold, we've had that type of behavior than not having it. We monitor the past and history now with our current moral viewpoint, which is a very big mistake to make. We're not really venerating our ancestors and understanding why they did certain things. Again, it doesn't necessarily make it right or whatnot, but there is a reasoning behind the madness, if you know what I'm saying.
Oh, yes. I mean, I agree. There is a very, I don't know if the word is arrogant, but the word arrogant is really not appropriate, but it's a lack of understanding and appreciation of what it takes to create a modern society and
yes,
how we arrive at the point that we are now.
Exactly.
And there's a lack of thankfulness and ignorance as well. And at the same time, it's also worth realizing that affluence creates bad habits and leads to a lack of moral character as well that is exhibited by these people. I mean, for me, when you put down your own ancestors, your own history in front of people from other countries that have just arrived here, like in the case of Toronto and Vancouver, as I walk through the University of Toronto and the University of British Columbia, and I see that they're overwhelmingly Asian, and I see these whites just putting themselves down and apologizing, I don't see anything noble about that. It's just pathetic. It's embarrassing to watch them do that. And I have been to those universities and I have asked them, the professors, why do you do this? How do you face the classroom and keep debasing yourself? They don't respect you, the Asians, when they see you doing that. I mean, they'll welcome it because they'll take over because you're handing them your heritage and your country. But these are not things that you can admire. Whereas when I look back at the past and I look at the Canadians who created Canada in an extremely difficult climate, I mean, when the lights go off here and you don't have heating in the winter, you realize how tough it must have been. And that you're not even thankful, and all you can point to is how the natives were expropriated and that kind of thing. It's just really pathetic. There's no virtue there. They have no morality on their side. They're just exploiting and misusing the resources and advantages that were handed to them by past generations. So I don't think they have morality on their side. I think that my side, the people that I'm aligned with, we are the ones who have morality on our side.
How would you, confront that the territory discussion and this very view that in the past we've had a more of a tribal mindset than, if you will, which was about expansion. It was about taking over, seizing as much as you can for the purposes of attaining more security, really, when it comes to surviving and everything else, that this is somehow now something that's pinned upon people who are alive today, let's say, who are alive in Canada or the United States or other countries, Australia or something like that. How do you approach that subject with someone then who has a complete view that, the whites that are there today are the guilties and they are the ones who should, kind of give way now and give back the land, if you will, or something like that? How would you approach that debate?
Well, when I teach, I don't teach Canadian history, but I make references to the people who first settled in Canada, the pioneers. I don't call them colonizers, I call them pioneers.
Yeah.
That came to Canada. I portray them in a positive light. I talk about the harshness of life and what it meant to be able to survive here. And I do mention the natives, and I do talk about the fact that there is a tragic element in life and that some people did pay a price. I'm not advocating imperialism today and colonization of other peoples. I think that we live in a different world and that these things are things of the past in some respect. Although at the same time, I do think that human beings are characters that are driven by tension and conflict, and that will always remain part of human existence. But I'm willing to advocate the idea of self-determination of ethnic groups throughout the world, including the self-determination of European peoples to have their own nation and not to feel obligated to accept anyone. I would have a moratorium on immigration, and I would even consider the fact that some people are going to have to be repatriated out of Europe for the sake of self-determination, in the same way that the Europeans call for Europeans to leave their lands. So, that's the way I talk about it. And I think what I'm saying is consistent, because I don't put down other ethnic groups. And even though it's true, for the sake of high culture, I do admire what the Europeans achieved. I understand well if someone from Korea says, I like my culture and we have these virtues. I would not try and negate that or compete with them. I think that every people, even the Eskimos here in Canada, have their own virtues, because it was so difficult for them to survive in this climate. And they cope with their own environment and they have their own identity. And I find that Canada, in a sense, is right to give them some territories for them to be autonomous, because I think assimilation would liquidate them and they would lose everything if they're forced to assimilate to Canada. I used to believe in the idea of assimilation, but now I think that's not a good idea. That comes from the right-wing liberals. But I also reject multiculturalism as it is applied internally to each European nation. I don't mind multiculturalism across the world, but not inside Western white nations, because that's where it's been implemented. And eventually it will lead to the dissolution of European nations.
I want to ask you more about that. And we've talked before on this program about the mass immigration into the northern countries, Sweden specifically. We see it into France and England and everything else, and how you view that and what you think is going to change because of it. We've obviously seen a lot of conflict because of this already, and I've continued to point it out that the lack of discussion on this is something that is leading to an increasingly volatile situation, shall we say. But one point before we leave the topic we were on previously here, was to want to wing this by one of the discussion points that I've heard about the characteristics of, conflict, if you will, was something that was applicable to most cultures and most people. But when the West partook in the same set of behaviors over territory, war, etc., they were somehow treated differently and singled out as a particularly ruthless or vicious people. I mean, we know about the massive bloodshed and, strife between many of the South American tribes, the American Indian tribes as well. But then when the European peoples partook in the same set of behaviors, they were singled out as that's now it's something different, right? Am I correct in that that's a kind of an assessment?
Oh, yes. There is a double standard, and it's a peculiar double standard because it presupposes and it assumes on the part of the leftist critic that somehow Europeans should not be engaging in those behaviors. And if you ask, well, why not? I mean, they're not going to answer this directly, but it presupposes that they are superior. They should behave in a morally better way. And it is to be expected that other people are not going to behave this way. For example, in the case of Europe today, where you have rampant Muslim violence and raping of women there, if you make reference to this, they feel uncomfortable and they think, well, you know, they're trying to adapt. They come from a difficult background. You shouldn't be judging them in this way. Just allow them to kind of just slowly become, if you like us. And then at that point, you sort of say, well, okay, so you're saying that they have a lower level of cultural behavior than the white leftists. So that's the first thing. There's an element of presumption that white leftists stand on a higher moral ground, at the same time that they are debasing themselves and saying that we in the West exploited them and we have been imperial in the past and we did things that these people somehow never did, and they were more harmonious, more natural and accommodating than we are, and they're superior than we are. So there are these thoughts that don't make sense in the mind of these people. So yeah, I mean, I agree with you. There is that going on.
Nonetheless, whatever your view on this is, then, should people that are alive today suffer from this? I mean, for example, I looked at some of the statistics before we started this recording, Ricardo, and let's see if I can find those notes here again. I think it was about 597,000 total slaves imported to the American colonies, or 400,000, something like that. And then, of course, this, what we saw consequent, and oh, by the way, that led to about 8% of all American families had slaves, which is not that much then. And yet today it feels like everyone is part of that and guilty of that. Nonetheless, even if their family way back, you know, if one believe in generational sin or whatever you want to call that, but nonetheless, it's very few then. But today that's kind of forgotten. And even the idea that to end slavery was also a Western instigated value, right? And we had approximately 620,000 men dying in the American Civil War, a huge tragedy over the issue to end slavery. So that's quite a bit been done on that front, if you know what I'm saying.
Yes, and to go back to an earlier point, to complete that point I wanted to make, the question that you asked, while the Europeans, as I said, have exhibited more dynamism and exuberance in the way they went about acquiring new lands and creating empires, they were also responsible in a unique way for the abolition of slavery and then imposing that abolition on other peoples that wanted to continue it,
right,
including the Muslim people. And we know as well that the Europeans were responsible as well for the idea that all human beings have to be treated as if they were the possessor of certain rights, certain natural rights. I mean, the Spaniards were the ones who first began to think in those terms. There were big debates taking place in 16th century Spain as to the exact status of the Indians. And the argument was made, and the king attended these arguments, one arguing to the effect that the Indians were not quite humans or not Christians, therefore some of the behavior of the Spaniards were justified, then others arguing that what the Spaniards were doing was inhuman, it was a violation of the natural rights of human beings or a violation of basic Christian principles. And the monarchy heard these arguments and actually sided with those who said that the Indians were human beings. I mean, these were very difficult times. They couldn't really impose the regulations that they enacted to try and treat them in a more humane way. But still, the point is that they begin a discussion whereby other non-Europeans were seen as human beings and possessors of natural rights equal to that of Europeans. And we could go on all the way to the idea of human rights. So this is something that was invented by the Europeans, the same ones who created the greatest empires. So then the other point you were making about in the South, yes, I have heard numbers that 5% of the whites in the South own slaves, but somehow we are supposed to think that today all whites are morally responsible or morally accountable,
right,
for the enslavement of blacks. So, I mean, yes, there are all kinds of ridiculous arguments. This is why I got out of the left. And later we can talk about the liberal right as well. But I agree that there is no way that you can hold generations today accountable. Many of these people, these white academics who are bringing these arguments, they live in predominantly white neighborhoods. They're a privileged minority. They earn secure incomes. They're not paying for the ideas that they're advocating. The people in England and Canada who are paying for mass immigration are the white working class in the main. The white working class in Marxist theory, not white, but the working class in Marxist theory was supposed to be the agent of revolution, but they were not that interested in Marxism. We jumped trade unionism and higher wages, and once they obtained that, they're pretty satisfied with bourgeois capitalist Western societies. Right. And perhaps they haven't forgiven them for that, for not performing the task they were supposed to perform. So the cultural Marxists began to look for other agents. It was women, and then it was blacks and all sorts of minorities. Now it's transsexuals, and any deviant you can find is now part of the critique. So they may have not forgiven the working class. And now when you think about it, what happened to the kulaks in the Soviet Union who were targeted and then liquidated in Ukraine is happening in a slow way and will happen to the white working class, because they are the ones who are going to suffer from this incoming of cheap labor. And they suffer in many other ways as well, because they tend to have the instincts that led them to see that something is wrong. They cannot articulate this intellectually, but the working class, when you talk to them, they know there is something wrong with this mass immigration. There is something wrong with diversity. It is the well-off liberals who live in the safe neighborhoods who like to advocate this and gain moral status points this way. It's very hypocritical. This is why it really angers me, because these people are immoral and they're hypocrites and they're not to be trusted.
We've talked about the champagne socialists out of the Fabian Society many times in the program, and this kind of fits into this idea as well. They advocate, you know, massive taxes, for example, on the rest of the global population really much, while they're sitting around with millions at their disposal, you know. But this line of thinking also comes out of the Frankfurt School that we mentioned before. And to clarify the point that you mentioned, you're pretty much talking about critical theory here, right? From Herbert Marcuse, that comes out of the Frankfurt School. It's about an achievement to criticize anything that has to do with the Western world that puts it in a good light, right? To erode everything, all the conditions there. And I wanted to ask you if there's what you see that the purpose for this cultural erosion is. For example, we've talked a lot about conspiracy on this program, tying that into geopolitics, the desire to create a new world order, for example, a global government and centralize the power. And a component to succeed towards this goal has been to an attempt to erode cultures, erode heritage, to erode the concept of the nation state, to paint that in as bad light as possible, to kind of create a rootless human being, which has been kind of dispossessed in that regard, because they are much easier human beings to control. Because when you do not have a tie to your past, to your ancestry, to your culture, to your heritage overall, you're waving around in the dark trying to find anything to kind of latch onto, to grab an ideology. That's just how we function as human beings, right? So would you agree with that assessment? Or would you say that there's something else or more even to the goal of this cultural erosion of the West that we're seeing right now?
No, I agree with that assessment. And I think that's where the left liberals and the right wing or neocon liberals converge. It's something that I've been thinking about, and I've been meaning to write an article about it. The way in which the leftist Marxist critique of the West has converged with the corporate emphasis on universal markets, open borders, free mobility of peoples and capital across national boundaries. The fact that magazines like The Economist, Business Week, and newspaper after newspaper, they don't have any problem whatsoever with mass immigration into Europe. They may raise objections to radical Islamic people and how they're troublesome characters and they're not good immigrant workers and that sort of thing. But they really are not opposed to immigration. And they do, in the end, when you talk to right-wing liberals and you sort of keep dialoguing with them, some of them, I respect them because at least they're for free speech and they don't mind hearing the ideas that I have. But there's a sense in which they really think the enemy is ethnic nationalism, that that is something that's fascistic or Nazi-like and it has to be overcome. And we do need to create a cosmopolitan world order. And so I sort of ask myself, where does the left and the right wing converge on this? And yes, there are many points of tensions between those two groups, but in many ways, they're reinforcing each other and supporting each other because the left provides them with the cultural arguments for diversity, for the idea that, yes, we can have many ethnic groups and they can coexist harmoniously with each other. And what we need to do is to try and subdue the white races who rebel against this. And then the corporations, the people who think that Western nations are just marketplaces, they think, well, yeah, we need diversity and that's going to create an opportunity for new products. It may create a workplace where you have different ethnic groups. And as you mentioned, there are these it's working classes and the population in general are less cohesive, don't have any deep roots, and they're more subservient or more accepting to advertisement. And we can bring American football into England and then possibly into other countries and propagate the idea of racial mixings and blacks being really good at sports and so on. And so I do see a convergence. Many people, the last thing, they're having this mighty struggle with the business people and the capitalists who are members of the 1%, and they're really fighting for the small person. But when you think about it, I mean, even Republicans, they have accepted a lot of the arguments and viewpoints of the left, whether it is gay rights, whether it is immigration and diversifying the population. They have no problem with that. And so I just think it's an interesting phenomenon that still needs to be analyzed, how it is that cultural Marxism has converged with capitalism, if you like.
Yeah.
I mean, Marxism was supposed to be against capitalism, and then it said, well, capitalism cannot be undermined unless you also undermine the culture that is associated with it. But what has happened is that these Marxists who went about undermining Western culture, which they did, have somehow found themselves fitting in and serving and working for a capitalist society, because capitalism can coexist and may well feel that it benefits from a culture that is not cohesive and not Western oriented and stable as it was in the past, but it is free-floating and believes in all this diversity.
Well, that's got to be a Fabian trait, though, right? Because, I mean, if we look at how the Fabian Society remolded, for example, the Labour Party under Tony Blair in the UK when he was in power, he right. definitely adopted the third way politics of actually using the markets. I mean, in ideology, they are Fabian socialists, right? And the idea there, we're talking about evolutionary socialism as opposed to revolutionary. They realize that a revolution will be too drastic, it will occur too quick, we have to do, you know, slow it down so people don't even notice. That's how you boil the frog, right? So allow the existence of the market, use it for the purposes to create this global state that you talked about, Ricardo. And then at the end, and the question is, of course, okay, but what's going to happen with that? So, I mean, it isn't really a free market. They try to claim that it is, but what's going to happen with that market at the end of the day? They could be eroded, it could be taken away, it could be brought into a complete subjugation under state control, let's say, at the end of it, meaning that they've piggybacked on the functionality of the market because it transcends borders and everything else. But that at the end of it, they're definitely going to turn their back on that system and they're going to bring in their global, you know, communist dictatorship, you know?
Yeah, no, that's a very good point, because I was having a discussion with someone and he was saying that the cultural Marxists are useful idiots. They're being used by the pro-corporate people. But I doubt that. I think
it's the other way around.
Right. I started thinking in many ways, as you just pointed out, that the cultural Marxists may well know what their long-term goals are. And they feel, you know, as long as we take the culture, rather than slowly, we are also taking the economy, and we're going to create a population that doesn't fit in with the kind of more competitive, open market that, you know, a libertarian would want. And plus, if you undermine the culture, the kind of capitalist society that you're going to create is not quite the society that they would want, because it creates a lot of welfare dependency. I mean, it is being argued right now that in the case of the United States, one of the reasons why the Democratic Party is for mass immigration is that they create people or have people in the United States who look to the government for solutions, whereas the white population in the United States is more of the view that you shouldn't look for the federal government for solutions. And yes, I mean, I think it's an interesting thing. I mean, who's using who in the long term?
Yeah.
I agree with you, because this person was saying, no, I mean, this is all being driven by capitalist globalization and the left doesn't realize how they're being used. But the argument can be made that the left really knows what it wants, and they're not being used. They will take over the culture and be on top.
Yeah, I urge people to check out what's known as Clause 4, because that's a hint towards where this ideology kind of is based from. Tony Blair in 1993, he had a fight to repeal or revise Clause 4. It was written out of a pamphlet for the Fabian Society and was basically to talking about the you know, common ownership kind of ideas of bringing in worker cooperatives and basically subjugating the business world under government control, right? And so what they did in the Labour Party is that they revoked this Clause 4, and which of course created an internal strife in the Labour Party, and they said, oh my God, they're giving up on their ideals, right? They're turning the back on the true ideology of the Labour Party. But I believe that that's just temporarily in place. I mean, it's been a long time, but as you said, they're long-term planners. This is the, you know, that's why they use the turtle as their symbol. You know, when we strike hard, goes the slogan for the Fabian Society. And they're sitting around patiently waiting for the right opportunity to take charge over something. So if people look at Clause 4, they can realize that, okay, they were willing to give up this ideal to get into power, to take control, to start, you know, subjugating the market economy under the government ownership and leadership. And then eventually down the road somewhere, Clause 4 is going to be brought back into the picture again. And then it's going to be under control and, you know, mission accomplished, mission achieved. But they, for all that time, they've managed to stay in power and operate and slowly move towards the kind of government that they want to see in the world. So I think they're very clever and they know exactly what they're doing on that front.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that point. I'm going to look into that, the Fabian and Tony Blair and all that. I haven't looked into it. I know about the third way of Tony Blair.
Yeah.
But yes, I'm going to look into this, because I have a student who is doing a PhD. It's very rare. I mean, she kind of agrees with all this stuff, but yeah, she would be interested in this kind of research, because she's looking into this, how these two things converge together, the cultural Marxism and the corporate world.
And I mean, that's something, just to clarify that point again, that we've had that system in Sweden for the longest time, that we've been able to see how it's a corporate socialism, for the lack of a better term. It is really is that merging of both those systems And of course, using the worst aspects of both of those systems. And then at the same time, on top of that, we've seen also, you know, mass immigration into the northern countries. Sweden specifically, we have about 16% of our population as immigrants now. And we see a lot of cultural conflicts. We have major riots last year in the suburbs in Stockholm. It's been a lot of violence down in Malmö suburbs there as well. While at the same time, then the media refuse to recognize that there is that this kind of scenario is leading to any problem, which is, of course, you know, making it even worse, which is also, I believe, part of that plan. But if we look at Europe and what is happening right now, how much of that would you say is a plan for mass immigration? I mean, it's something that's, I believe, is unprecedented in history when the West is willingly opening, well, willingly, this hasn't been democratically you know, elected, of course. This is just something that politicians are doing and said, this is what's happening and that's it. And that's the end of it. We don't have any say in it. But what will that lead to, do you think? What kind of problems will arise out of these cultural conflicts and clash of civilizations that we're seeing?
Well, one of the things that surprised me, I'm not an expert on immigration or multiculturalism. It was something that I began to be interested in because I started thinking about the decline of the West after I wrote the book. But one of the things that struck me right away is how fast this happened once they began to think about immigration and rejecting, in the case of Australia and Canada and the United States, the white-only policies that were in place. And the way in which they were rejected almost simultaneously in Canada and the United States, the 1965 Immigration Act was passed, which opened the borders to people from all over the world. In Canada, it was around the same time, in the early 60s, you see a movement against immigration restrictions from Asia. And then finally, I think in 1967, basically they abolished all restrictive immigration that would only permit people from European countries here. And then in Australia a few years later, and then in England, it's a different sequence of events, but comparable in terms of when you see mass immigration from Africa and other Asian countries. And then soon after, you see it in Sweden and other Nordic countries and so on. So it kind of took me aback that this is a phenomenon that really takes off in the 60s and accelerates thereafter. And why did it happen like that everywhere? And, you know, you kind of wonder, I mean, is this a conspiracy? Was it implemented from above? Because we know sure. that people were not consulted. We know they did not put this to a vote anywhere.
No.
It was done behind the backs of everyone. In fact, they knew, the elites, that people out there would not accept this. That if you ask them, when you read some of the government documents, they say, look, you know, if we start talking about immigration from areas other than the normal areas of the past, the public is not going to accept it. They're not going to be willing to change the character of their countries. So they did it behind their backs. They lied to them. They told them, in the case of the United States, oh, well, don't worry. Not that many people are going to come from elsewhere. The same thing in Australia, that look, we will have immigration from Asia, but it's not like they want to come here. And then suddenly you see them arriving and then begin to articulate all their arguments. So you sort of wonder what is going on here and why are they doing this? And why are they so determined to really subdue and demonize the opponents of immigration? Because it happened very fast. The prime minister in Canada in 1947, Mackenzie King, he could say to the public without any recrimination, he could say that he would like Canada to remain a European nation and not to have too many Asians, because that would change the character of Canadian society. And the Canadian public saw that was a normal statement. And you could go into the 1950s, people were still making statements like that. And I would say that still today, quite a few people would make statements like that. But they know that now all these regulations are in place, you're going to lose your job or you're going to be demonized, so you better stay silent. So I do think about that. How did this all happen so fast? Who was behind it? And there is a conspiratorial element to it, because it is and effort. And I was thinking about this yesterday, how it is or why it is that people do think about conspiracy a lot. And are they mad or they don't know what is happening and so on? I think the reason they think about that a lot is that there is a conspiratorial element to it. And part of it, the way I thought about it, is that the West is committed to this notion that they need to recreate a whole new world, that there is somehow something wrong. In the case of Sweden, there is some, even though Sweden achieved a lot with their policies through the 50s and 60s, I mean, you can talk about certain totalitarian aspects, and I don't welcome them, but by their standards, by their socialist standards, they achieve a lot of what they wanted. And then you ask yourself, well, what was it that you think you did not achieve? What was there still remaining to be achieved? Where do you want to go now? Like, what are you envisioning in the future? And so there is this thing that, yes, they're envisioning a future that they don't quite want to tell the population. And so they're imposing it behind their back slowly and gradually and hoping to get there. And this is happening not just in Sweden, but in other countries. So, you know, this is it's a big thing. It's happening only in Western countries. And I mean, the people from Asia, Japan are looking at us and really wondering, what are they doing? Like, what's gone with these people?
Yeah, exactly. And I know, by the way, after, I think it was the Council on Foreign Relations, one of the people out of that organization in the U.S. That has been blamed for quite a bit of nefarious, you know, activities, and rightly so, that argued that after the Fukushima and the you know, Daiichi nuclear situation, they wrote a paper, I read it, and they talked about how this is now a great opportunity for Japan to become multicultural. They have to open up their borders now and do all these things. So they were like, they're seeking to also over there, although they're very, I mean, in Japan, they're very much homogenized, you know, very much restrictive in their immigration policies and everything else. And I think that the many people in the West, it seems like they're part of the current global elite, are seeking to turn that on its head in those countries that yet haven't achieved that. But it seems like even if that's the goal or not, to do this to the entire world at the end of it, the West is definitely you know, an initial launching pad and the live experiment where this is taking place, right?
Yeah, that's what they think. They will be the launching pad. But I was at a conference in Azerbaijan, in Baku City, and they invited hundreds of people there, and one of the things was multiculturalism. And the politicians from Azerbaijan, they wanted to portray themselves and their country as a multicultural country. They're doing what other Western countries are doing. And one of the papers that I prepared for my presented for my talk was that what you have in the non-Western world when they talk about multiculturalism is something very different. It means simply that, let's say in Japan or South Korea, that if you have certain minorities existing there, that you will start recognizing that, you will accommodate them and allow them to maintain some of their customs and to be proud of them, and not to enforce the majority culture on everyone. So I said that that's just a recognition of the multicultural character of these nations. But that's not multiculturalism, which is an ism, which is an ideology. And I said it's an ideology that's only been practiced in Western countries. And you need to be aware of that, that you don't have multiculturalism. And I would not advise you to endorse multiculturalism, because multiculturalism cannot be disassociated from the idea of immigration. It means immigration from other lands. And the two are intertwined and connected. Canada was very multicultural before mass immigration began. In 1971, 96% of the population of Canada was European. That's very high, which means that Europeans created practically, well, I would say absolutely, all the institutions, the laws, the infrastructure, and the culture of this country.
Right.
And then, yes, in Canada in 1971. And then when multiculturalism was introduced as an official policy, it came very consciously with the idea that the borders must be open to the third world. And then began a series of campaigns to celebrate other ethnic groups, to condemn the past of Canada as being white and racist. And this has been going on and accelerating, and now everybody, including conservatives, accept this vision of multiculturalism and mass immigration combined. So I don't think other nations in the world, even though they're talking about multiculturalism, they're kind of playing around with it. But, you know, in South Korea, I think there is a law that says that they're not going to alter the character of their culture just because they have a labor shortage. Japan, I don't think, well, it has not opened its borders to other cultures, and I don't see Japan doing that. I don't see even Mexico. Mexico doesn't allow people from Central America to get into Mexico. I mean,
right.
Some of them do get in, but they don't allow them to get in. So this is only being implemented in white lands. And there is this idea that white people somehow, they're a problem on this earth and they need to be mixed. Like in my university, just today, I saw the new pictures that are there in the opening webpage. And you rarely see white males, even though white males are the majority in terms of males in the population here, because New Brunswick is still very European.
Mm-hmm.
But in the web pages, you see a black guy with a white female. Then you see mostly white females and then a few ethnic females. And then the only white guy you see, and you can see his face, is walking with a black female. So, I mean, this is it's sort of silly, but in every university webpage across Canada, they're promoting this kind of thing.
And why is that? Why are they promoting that?
Because they want us here in New Brunswick to start getting ready to embrace full diversity, and we need to become racially mixed. I mean, it's happening in the ads as well, everywhere. The next scene now that they're coming up with is women in particular, but also white males, need to start going out with non-whites and having children with them.
So is it racism to care for your culture and heritage and worry about the political agenda that exists from the cultural Marxists to undermine the Western world? Or is that used, do you think, as a derogatory term that is basically put in place to stifle criticism of mass immigration and what we're seeing? Because this is, after all, social engineering, right? This is a level of propaganda. It's not something that is meant to occur naturally because, let's say, it's people's choice or whatever, however they want to live their lives, right? I mean, I couldn't care less about that. But if we're in a different zone, if you will, when we realize that it comes in the forms of indoctrination and education, and it comes, you know, from the social sciences department and stuff like that, correct?
Yeah, it's massive engineering, worse than what you saw in the Soviet Union. And it's done in a very subtle way. It's done in the name of harmony, of racial togetherness, getting along, being open-minded, tolerant, welcoming, and cosmopolitan, and enriching yourself. I mean, the left has been so successful in appropriating word after word for their own purposes, and then imposing these other terms on those who question them. So racism, or you're a racist. I mean, when I Google my name, the first word that comes alongside my name is racist. I have never said in my view anything openly racist out there, but
yep.
I guess leftists search me and they put racist. They want to find stuff about me, or they think I'm a racist. You know, I in a way, I've been lucky that I'm in this university, which is small here on the margins in Canada, because I have been told by some people, you know, if you were in a bigger university, they would have come after you. They would have just really done something. But
because you represent really a diverse opinion then, right? But they don't want that. They want to have a uniformitarian kind of ideology coming out of every university in the entire world.
Yeah, I mean, I'm ostracized in my university. I don't fight with them because I will waste my time and be distracted, so I keep to myself. But basically, from being invited and being socialized with other people, that has all ended gradually. So that's what they'll do. And they're not even discuss issues with me. They don't have good arguments, in my estimation. I was a leftist, and I don't find their arguments strong at all.
And you yourself come from a multicultural background, correct?
Yeah, I was born in Puerto Rico, in the island of Puerto Rico. And I would say that I have some racial mixture. I think I'm predominantly white, and I do identify with white people in racial terms. And I basically think of myself as a Canadian. I've been here most of my life. And in terms of my education, my culture, I'm very Western. I'm overtly Eurocentric, I would say. I love Western civilization, the history, reading about Greece and Rome and the Middle Ages. But I do have a diverse element in me. I have a strong accent. So they think I'm a bit of a weirdo kind of guy. They kind of
right.
They can't comprehend me. They do. One of the things that I realized too is that it bothers them because they think that they're white people. They're gonna do good things for me and help me and assist me, and that didn't work. And I think it bothers them that too.
Now, speaking to what you said before there, because I was researching the European Union a couple of years ago for a presentation that I did on the hidden origins of the European Union. And I trace it back to one of the counts, Richard Coudenhove Kalergi. And I remember I came across this quote and I was like, what the hell is this? What does he mean with this? And it came out of his book called Practical Idealism. I think it was written in German primarily. He was working a lot together with Otto von Habsburg, who started the Pan-European movement together. And a lot of the proposals that they had very, very early on, we're talking about something that's way, way, way before he wrote this. It was published in Vienna in 1925. So it's not something coming out of this idea after the Second World War that, okay, we have to avoid war in Europe, therefore we have to, you know, create the European Union. No, that's all bull. It came much before that, much earlier. So Richard Coudenhove Kalergi, anyway, he talked about, and I never understood the quote. He said, the quote was following, "The man of the future will be a mongrel. Today's races and classes will disappear, owing to the disappearance of space, time, and prejudice. The Eurasian Negroid race of the future, similar in its outward appearance to the ancient Egyptians, will replace the diversity of peoples with a diversity of individuals." And I never understood that quote. I was like, what the hell is he talking about, you know? But now what you've said and what you've mentioned to me today, it's almost like now that makes sense all of a sudden, that the leaders in Europe are trying to fulfill the things that he talked about way back in 1925. Have you heard about this?
Yes, I have read that quote. I haven't studied him or his writings, but I have read that quote. And yes, it surprised me. And I remember bookmarking it to read it again. I think I read it last year in some web discussion. And right, he wrote that, you said 1925.
Yeah.
I don't know exactly who he is, but I would say that this idea that somehow there are these wars, and this was after the First World War, and there are these wars and conflicts and imperialistic acts, and that the way to solve them is to mix all the races and create a genetic being, is now deeply held. He was voicing that, probably one of the first ones that started voicing this idea of creating a genetic race as a solution to all these problems. I have a brother who believes in that. He openly says that the way to solve the problems of the world is to create a genetic race and right. Mix them all up.
Yeah.
So,
do you believe that's true? Is that something that could be achieved then?
I don't think it will be achieved because I don't think the non-whites will ever accept that. I don't think the Chinese or the Japanese or the Koreans or the Indians will accept that. When they come into white lands, quite a few of them like to mix with whites. Chinese women go out with white men in Vancouver and Toronto. You see a lot less white women going with Chinese guys. So you will also see a lot of black guys that want to go out with white women. So yes, you see other non-whites wanting to mix with whites, and then you see whites increasingly mixing with non-whites. So you see them doing that, but that's going to happen in the white world. I don't think all whites are going to mix, but the media is pushing for it in a considerable way. As a way, at least in the United States, you see the problem with blacks is there, and they don't know what to do with it, because you're supposed to believe that both are equal, and yet the standing and the achievements of both remain very unequal. And so they don't know what to do. So the way I think they're thinking is that they hope that at least a substantial number of whites will mix with the blacks and create a mixed race, and then that will raise the status of blacks and lower that of white, and they converge towards an average point that's more equal.
How do you think that we should view these political ideologies, if that's what they are, then, that they're trying to impose this upon people? Is this a noble quest? Is this something that should be, because it's obviously not something that's being discussed openly, right? This is just something that we should examine further and see what the validity of these claims are, and if they're doing this. I mean, I'm thinking back to an article that came out of the BBC. I linked it up recently on the website, that said that the blondes are going to die out in 200 years. They said the last natural blonde will die out within 200 years, believe a scientist. A study by German experts suggests people with blonde hair are an endangered species and will become extinct by 2202. And I think that they drew it down to basically people in Finland are going to have the last natural proportions of blondes left, right? So how should we view things like that?
Well, I mean, the people who say this, quite a few of them, either don't care or welcome it. Obviously, we should view it as a threat. And my view is that whites need to start thinking in racial terms. They need to start thinking that there is this movement against them, that they're being targeted, they've been demonized. I mean, you even look at Romney, the prior presidential candidate for the Republican Party. There were complaints in the American press that his family was too white, because I think he had 7 children, did he have? And then his children had children, and so when they took a picture of them, they were all white. So some people said, this doesn't make sense. This family doesn't square with the reality of America today. It's just too white. So as I was telling my students, it's almost as if they're saying that if whites don't have black children, then they're discriminating against them. So amazingly enough, the Romney family adopted an African kid. And now they have a picture with their adopted African kid there, kind of saying to the public, like, look, we're not that white. We have an African kid. So, you know, it's insane, but this is what is going on. And race has been excluded from discussion. We're not supposed to talk about it. We're supposed to say it is a construct, but we cannot avoid it because it is the weapon they're using. It is where they're taking it, the war against the West. It's now a war against the white race. And so unless whites come to identify themselves as white and to have a sense of dignity in themselves, because really it comes down to a sense of pride. And you know, if you're a man of manliness about your people and speaking out, if you don't do that, you will be, the white people will be overwhelmed.
But obviously we've been taught that this very notion is racism, right? So no one is going to go there. I mean, what would you say to people that hold this view, that are associate this concern, then, let's say, with racism? Is it racism?
No, it's not racism. You're going to argue that they're the ones who are racist because they want to, I mean, you gave some prognosis or predictions about what will happen eventually to white people. If that will happen and you're reacting against it, it is not racism. You could argue they're the ones who are racist because they want to commit genocide against white people. They want to exterminate them. There are UN documents that stipulate that any effort to eliminate a particular racial group is genocide if you go about it in a systematic way, as they are doing. So that's not racism. They are the ones who are racist. And I think a lot of people, white people, are going to have to come to the realization that they have to pay the price of being called racist if they want to survive. Eventually, as people call you that, you get used to it, and it doesn't mean really anything. Even in my case, I don't care if somebody tells me I'm a racist. That doesn't mean anything to me anymore, because that's just a leftist using a name, and I don't accept their terms or their premises. So that's fine. They can say whatever they want.
So with what you've been talking about here so far, and some of the, you know, conclusions here, how widespread would you say that this agenda is that we've been talking about? Is it just a few people on the fringe of the, you know, elite that seeks to create this, you know, global government that holds this view? Or how influential have the policies been of the people within the Frankfurt School, the Fabian Society, and the cultural Marxists that we've been talking about? Is this something that's like, you know, kind of embedded into the power structure of Western civilization now, or is it just a few people? How would you view that?
Oh, no, it is widespread. It is institutionalized. It is everywhere. They control all the public schools. They control the universities. They control the newspapers. They control the political parties. My viewpoint, I will never be interviewing any radio station. My book is not reviewed by conventional academics. They avoid it. A few did, but most of them avoid it. Certainly the writings I have published recently, they are being ignored completely by them. But it's not even about that or about me. The fact is that if you look at the political parties in Canada, the United States, or anywhere else, they advocate and are okay with multiculturalism and mass immigration. None of them seriously question it. So this is pervasive in the media, in Hollywood, in the newspapers. You see it everywhere. So, you know, this is a battle for survival at this point. If people don't really want that kind of future, if people from Sweden and Norway want to preserve their identity, if you believe that Swedish identity is important, I mean, before you said that 16%, I didn't know it was that high, that 16% in Sweden now is immigrant non-white. I thought it was 10%, but it may be increasing continuously.
This is the numbers I read from the statistical, you know, the Swedish Census Bureau, basically. I don't know how they divide that up, but the immigration-wise, 16% is immigrants, nonetheless.
Yeah, that's very high. Yeah. And I have read about other numbers, cities across Europe, in France and England, it's worse. You know, this is something that, to me, it is the issue of our times. It is the most important issue. In my book, I wasn't talking about immigration. In fact, in my book, I said that the West was a culture, essentially, and that did not have ethnic boundaries. I wouldn't say that now. Actually, in a subsequent publication under a pen name, I did argue that the West, European culture, cannot be disassociated from ethnicity, that it is a factor. It is not the factor, but it is a very important factor. To me, a society in which whites are a minority ceases to be a Western society. It becomes something else. And so if we want to preserve European Western civilization, we're going to have to preserve European ethnicity.
All right. Well, we could continue the discussion. Obviously, there are many more questions I have about your view on these topics, but we'll have to wait for another time, Ricardo. We'll begin to round things up here for this time. And I want to thank you for your perspective as well. It's one that we seldom hear, of course, and it's interesting to hear that you've been able to just kind of talk about this from a view of the university that you're part of, considering that you just mentioned that so few hold, you know, these kinds of ideas and study these kinds of items. And of course, when they do, they get kicked out of those universities. They get basically frozen out of it. So that's telling in itself, right? There was someone who was argued that you know, truth fears no investigation, right? But there seems to be certain issues and topics that you just you're just not allowed to talk about them. And I've never understood why, you know, if it's something that's happening, if it's social engineering, if it's something by these very institutionalized academics that occur in the educational world, then of course we have to talk about it, right? We have to get it out in the open and see what's going on.
They're afraid because we have science on our side, we have human nature, we have history, we have loyalty, pride, all the good things are on our side. And on their side, they have infantile views about human togetherness and a lot of deception and manipulation. So they don't have ethics on their side. I thought they did, but they don't.
All right. The book is called The Uniqueness of Western Civilization Studies in Critical Social Sciences, and it's linked up. We're going to have it linked up on Amazon. We're also going to link to the publisher, Brill.com, where it's available. Do you have any other titles or books that you've written, Ricardo, that you'd like to mention as well, or is that the one?
Well, now when I publish something, I put it on my profile. So some new articles have been put there that people can read. And I have another one coming out soon that they will also see there. So that would be my suggestion, that they can see these things in my profile.
All right, the unb.ca. We're going to have that linked up. It's kind of a longer URL, so it's a little bit more difficult to read it here online. But we'll have it on the program page on redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com. So take a look there if you want to read more of the selected publications that Ricardo has up there and read more about the book as well. All right. Well, thank you, Ricardo, for coming on the program. Very interesting and challenging, but very important and perspective, as I said, that we haven't heard about before. So thank you for sharing it with us.
All right. Thanks. And that was a very good interview and question. So I appreciate it.
Okay. There you go. Thank you for listening and for considering. I hope you have some new items to contemplate and can view some of the topics we discussed in a different light and consider some of the points brought up by Ricardo Duchesne. We have a lot more coming as we continue to examine other areas with Dale Hurd, Robert Morningstar, Zoltan Istvan, Maria Kvillhaug, Daryl Hamamoto, and many more. Also, don't miss the next Radio 314 with Megan Kellison on Bitcoin and the state. Thank you so much for being a member and that you continue to listen to new perspectives for considering, learning, and thinking. Don't forget to comment at redicemembers.com as well. And we'll be back in just a few. In the meantime, we say have a great rest of your day. And I want to thank the Red Ice crew for all their hard work as well. Be well, stay focused and healthy, and we'll pick up our conversation in just a few days. In the meantime, we'll see you on the websites.